Chapter 28. Crimson Thorn. It hardly seemed the setting for the explosion Elaine feared. Harlan Bridge was a village of moderate size, with three inns and enough houses that no one had to sleep in a hayloft. When Elaine and Birgitta went downstairs to the common room that morning, Mistress Dill, the round innkeeper, smiled warmly and offered as much of a curtsy as her size allowed. It was not just that Elaine was Aes Sedai. Mistress Dill was so pleased that her inn was full, what with the roads snow-packed, that she bobbed at nearly everyone. At their entrance, Avienda hastily gulped the last of her breakfast bread and cheese, brushed a few crumbs from her green dress, and snatched up her dark cloak to join them. Outside, the sun was just peeking over the horizon, a low dome of pale yellow. Only a few clouds marred a beautiful blue sky, and they were white and fluffy. Not the sort to carry snow. It seemed a wonderful day for traveling. Except that Adelais was trampling a path up the snowy street, and the white-haired sister was dragging one of the kin, Garinia Rosuinde, by her arm. Garinia was a slim-hipped Saldean who had spent the last 20 years as a merchant, although she looked only a few years older than Nynaeve did. Normally her strongly hooked nose gave her a forceful appearance, a woman who would make hard trading and not back away. Now her dark, tilted eyes were large in her face, and her wide mouth hung open, emitting a wordless wail. A growing knot of kinswomen followed behind, skirts held high out of the snow, whispering among themselves, with more running from every direction to join. Rihanna and the rest of the knitting circle were in the front, all grim-faced except for Kirstian, who seemed even paler than usual. Elise was there, too, wearing an utterly blank expression. Adelais stopped in front of Elaine and shoved Garinia so hard the woman fell to hands and knees in the snow, where she stayed, still wailing. The kinswomen gathered behind her, more of their number flocking in. "I'm bringing this to you because Nynaeve is busy," the brown sister told Elaine. She meant that Nynaeve was enjoying a little time alone with Lan somewhere, but for once not so much as a hint of a smile crossed her lips. "Be quiet, child," she snapped at Garinia, who promptly went silent. Adelais gave a satisfied nod. "This is not Garinia Rosuinde," she said. "I finally recognized her. Zarya Alcaesa. A novice who ran away just before Van Deen and I decided to retire and write our history of the world. She admitted it when I confronted her. I'm surprised Kariana didn't recognize her before this. They were novices together for 2 years. The law is clear, Elaine. A runaway must be put back in white as soon as possible and kept under strict discipline until she can be returned to the tower for proper punishment. She won't think of running again after that." Elaine nodded slowly, trying to think of what to say. Whether or not Zarya thought of running again, she would not be allowed the opportunity. She was very strong in the power. The tower would not let her go if it took the rest of her life to earn the shawl. But Elaine was recalling something she had heard this woman say the first time she met her. The meaning had not registered then, but now it did. How would Zarya face novice white again after living as her own woman for 70 years? Worse, those whispers among the kinswomen had begun to sound like rumbles. She did not have long to think. Suddenly Kirstian fell to her knees, clutching at Adelais's skirts with one hand. "I submit myself," she said calmly, her tone a wonder coming from that bloodless face. "I was enrolled in the novice book almost 300 years ago, and ran away less than a year later. I submit myself and beg mercy." It was white-haired Adelais's turn to go wide-eyed. Kirstian was claiming to have run away from the White Tower when she herself was an infant, if not before she was born. Most of the sisters still did not really believe the ages claimed by the kin. Indeed, Kirstian appeared just into her middle years. Even so, Adelais recovered herself quickly. However old the other woman was, Adelais had been Aes Sedai about as long as anyone living. She carried an aura of age and authority. "If that is so, child," her voice did falter just a bit at that, I fear we must put you in white, too. You will still be punished, but surrendering as you have will gain you some mitigation. That is why I did it. Kirstjan's steady tone was spoiled somewhat by a hard swallow. She was almost as strong as Zarya. None of the knitting circle were weak, and she would be held very closely. I knew you would find me out, sooner or later. Adelius nodded as though that were clearly obvious, though how the woman would have been found out Elaine could not guess. She very much doubted that Kirstjan Chalwin was the name the woman had been born with. Most of the kin believed in Aes Sedai omniscience, though. They had, at least.
Rubbish!
Serenia Vostovan's husky voice cut through the murmured babble of the kin. Neither strong enough to become Aes Sedai nor nearly old enough to stand very high among the kin, she still stepped from the pack defiantly.
Why should we give them up to the White Tower? We have helped women run away, and rightly so. It is not part of the rules to give them back.
Control yourself, Rihanna said sharply.
Alice, take Serenia in hand, please. It seems she forgets too many of the rules she claims to know.
Alice looked at Rihanna, her face still unreadable.
Alice, who enforced the kin's rules with a firm hand.
It is not part of our rules to hand runaways back, Rihanna, she said. Rihanna jerked as though struck.
And how do you suggest keeping them? She demanded finally. We have always held runaways apart until we were sure they were no longer hunted, and if they were found before, we let the sisters take them. That is the rule, Alice. What other rule do you propose violating? Do you suggest that we actually set ourselves against Aes Sedai?
Ridicule of such a notion larded her voice, yet Alice stood looking at her, silent.
Yes, a voice shouted from the crowd of kinswomen. We are many, and they are few.
Adelia stared at the crowd in disbelief. Elaine embraced Sidar, though she knew the voice was right. The kin were too many. She felt Avienda embracing the power, and Birgitta setting herself. Giving herself a shake as if coming to, Alice did something far more practical, certainly far more effective.
Serenia, she said loudly, you will report to me when we stop tonight with a switch you cut yourself before we leave this morning. You too, Asra. I recognize your voice.
And then just as loudly she said to Rihanna,
I will report myself for your judgment when we stop tonight. I don't see anyone getting ready.
The kinswomen broke up quickly then, heading off to gather their things, yet Elaine saw some of them talking quietly as they went. When they rode over the bridge across the frozen stream that wound down beside the village, with Nynaeve incredulous over what she had missed and glaring about for someone to call down, Serenia and Asra carried switches, as did Alice, and Zarya and Kirstjan wore hastily found white dresses beneath their dark cloaks. The windfinders pointed at them and laughed uproariously. But many of the kinswomen still talked in clusters, falling silent whenever a sister or one of the knitting circle looked at them. And there was a darkness to their eyes when they looked at Aes Sedai. 8 more days of floundering through the snow when it was not falling, and grinding her teeth in an inn when it was. 8 more days of brooding by the kin, of staring bleakly at the sisters, days of strutting by the windfinders around kin and Aes Sedai alike. On the morning of the 9th day, Elaine began to wish everyone had simply gone for everyone else's throat. She was just wondering whether they could cover the last 10 miles to Camelin without a murder, when Kirstjan rapped at her door and darted in without waiting for an answer. The woman's plain woolen dress was not the shade of white proper for a novice, and she had regained much of her dignity somehow, as if knowing her future had smoothed her present. But now she made a hasty curtsy, almost tripping over her cloak, and her nearly black eyes were anxious.
Nynaeve Sedai, Elaine Sedai, Lord Lan says you are to come at once, she said breathlessly. He told me to speak to no one, and you aren't to either.
Elaine and Nynaeve exchanged looks with Avienda and Birgitta. Nynaeve growled something under her breath about the man not knowing private from public, but it was clear before she blushed that she did not believe it. Elaine felt Birgitta focus, the drawn arrow hunting a target.
Kirstjan did not know what Lan wanted, only where she was to lead them. The small hut outside of Cullen's Crossing, where Adelius had taken Ispan the night before. Lan stood outside, his eyes as cold as the air, and would not let Kirstjan enter. When Elaine went inside, she saw why. Adelius lay on her side beside an overturned stool, a cup on the rough wooden floor not far from one outstretched hand. Her eyes stared, and a pool of congealed blood spread out from the deep slash across her throat. Ispan lay on a small cot, staring at the ceiling. Lips drawn back in a rictus bared her teeth, and her bulging eyes seemed full of horror, as well they might have, since a wrist-thick wooden stake stood out from between her breasts. The hammer that had plainly been used to drive it in lay beside the cot, on the edge of a dark stain that ran back under the cot. Elaine forced herself to stop thinking about emptying her stomach on the spot. "Light," she breathed. "Light! Who could do this? How could anyone do this?" Avienda shook her head wonderingly, and Lan did not even bother with that. He just watched nine directions at once as though he expected whoever or whatever had committed this murder to come through one of the two tiny windows, if not through the walls. Birgitta drew her belt knife, and by her face she dearly wished she had her bow. That drawn arrow was stronger than ever in Elaine's head. At first, Nynaeve simply stood in one spot, studying the hut's interior. There was little to see, aside from the obvious. A second three-legged stool, a rough table holding a flickering lamp, a green teapot and a second cup, a rude stone fireplace with cold ash on the hearthstone. That was all. The hut was so small it only took Nynaeve a step to reach the table. Dipping her finger into the teapot, she touched it to the tip of her tongue, then spat vigorously and emptied the whole teapot onto the table in a wash of tea and tea leaves. Elaine blinked wonderingly. "What happened?" Van Deen asked coolly from the door. Lan moved to bar her way, but she stopped him with a small gesture. Elaine started to put an arm around her and received another raised hand to keep her back. Van Deen's eyes remained on her sister, calm in a face of Aes Sedai serenity. The dead woman on the cot might as well not have existed. "When I saw all of you heading this way, I thought... we knew we didn't have many years remaining, but..." Her voice sounded serenity itself, but small wonder if that was a mask. "What have you found, Nynaeve?" Sympathy looked odd on Nynaeve's face. Clearing her throat, she pointed to the tea leaves without touching them, to white shavings among the matted black leaves. "This is crimson thorn root," she said, trying to sound matter-of-fact and failing. "It's sweet, so you might miss it in tea unless you know what it is, especially if you take a lot of honey." Van Deen nodded, never taking her eyes from her sister. "Adelius developed a taste for sweet tea in Ebudar." "A little kills pain," Nynaeve said. This much kills, but slowly, even a few sips would be enough." Taking a deep breath, she added, "They might have remained conscious for hours, not able to move, but aware. Either whoever did this didn't want to risk someone coming too soon with an antidote, not that I know one for a brew this strong, or else they wanted one or the other to know who was killing them." Elaine gasped at the brutality, but Van Deen simply nodded. "Ispan, I think, since they appear to have taken the most time with her." The white-haired Green almost seemed to be thinking aloud, working out a puzzle. Cutting a throat took less time than driving a stake through someone's heart. The calm of her made Elaine's skin crawl. "Adelius would never have accepted anything to drink from someone she didn't know, not out here with Ispan. Those two facts name her killer in a way. A dark friend, and one of our party. One of us." Elaine felt two chills, her own and Birgitta's. "One of us," Nynaeve agreed sadly. Avienda began testing the edge of her belt knife on her thumb, and for once Elaine felt no objection. Van Deen asked to be left alone with her sister for a few moments and sat on the floor to cradle Adelius in her arms before they were out of the door. Jame, Van Deen's gnarled old warder, was waiting outside with a shivering Christian. Suddenly a wail burst out inside the hut, the full-throated cry of a woman mourning the loss of everything. Nynaeve, of all people, turned to go back, but Lan laid a hand on her arm, and Jame planted himself before the door with eyes not much warmer than Lan's. There was nothing to do but leave them, Van Deen to shriek her pain, and Jame to guard her in it. And share it, Elaine realized, feeling that knot of emotions in her head that was Birgitta. She shivered, and Birgitta put an arm around her shoulders. Avienda did the same from the other side, and motioned for Nynaeve to join them, which she did after a moment. The murder Elaine had thought of so lightly had come. One of their companions was a dark friend, and the day suddenly felt cold enough to shatter bones, but there was a warmth in the closeness of her friends. The last 10 funereal miles to Camelin took 2 days in the snow, with even the windfinders decently subdued. Not that they pushed Marilla any less hard. Not that Kin stopped talking, and falling silent whenever a sister or one of the knitting circle came near. Van Deen, with her sister's silver-mounted saddle on her horse, appeared as serene as she had at Adelius's graveside, but James' eyes carried a silent promise of death that surely rode in Van Deen's heart, too. Elaine could not have been happier to see the walls and towers of Camelin if the very sight had given her the rose crown and brought back Adelius. Even Camelin, one of the great cities of the world, had never seen the likes of their party before, and once inside the 50-foot walls of grey stone they attracted notice as they crossed the new city along wide, slush-filled streets, bustling with people and carts and wagons. Shopkeepers stood in their doorways and gaped. Wagon drivers reined in their teams to stare. Towering Aiel men and tall maidens eyed them from every corner, it seemed. The people seemed to take no notice of the Aiel, but Elaine did. She loved Avienda as she did herself, more, but she could not love an army of armed Aiel walking Camelin's streets. The inner city, ringed by towered walls of silver-streaked white, was a remembered delight, and Elaine finally began to feel that she was coming home. The streets followed the curves of the hills, and every rise presented a new vista of snow-covered parks and monuments laid out to be seen from above, as well as up close, of brightly tiled towers shining with 100 colors in the afternoon sun. And then the royal palace itself was before them, a confection of pale spires and golden domes and intricate stonework traceries. The banner of Andor waved from nearly every prominence, the white lion on red. And from the others, the dragon banner, or the banner of light. At the tall gilded gates of the palace, Elaine rode forward alone in her travel-stained grey riding dress. Tradition and legend said women who first approached the palace in splendor always failed. She had made clear that she had to do it alone, yet she almost wished Avienda and Birgitta had succeeded in overruling her. Half the 2 dozen guards in front of the gates were Aiel maidens, the others men in blue helmets and blue coats, with a red and gold dragon marching across the chest. "I am Elaine Trakand," she announced loudly, surprised at how calm she sounded. Her voice carried, and across the great plaza people turned from staring at her companions to stare at her. The ancient formula rolled from her tongue. "In the name of House Trakand, by right of descent from Ishara, I have come to claim the Lion Throne of Andor, if the light wills it so." The gates opened wide. It would not be that easy, of course. Even possession of the palace was not enough to hold the throne of Andor by itself. Passing her companions into the care of an astonished Rhene Harfor, and very pleased to see that the graying first maid, round and as regal as any queen, still had the palace in her capable hands, and a coterie of servants in red and white livery, Elaine hurried to the grand hall, the throne room of Andor, alone again. This was not part of the ritual, not yet. She should have been going to change into the red silk with the pearl-worked bodice and white lions climbing the sleeves, but she felt compelled. This time not even Nynaeve tried to object. White columns, 20 paces high, marched down the sides of the grand hall. The throne room was empty still. That would not last long. Clear afternoon light through the glassed casements in tall windows along the walls mingled with the colored light through the great windows set in the ceiling, where the white lion of Andor alternated with scenes of Andoran victories and the faces of the land's earliest queens, beginning with Ishara herself, as dark as any of the Atha Anmir, as full of authority as any Aes Sedai. No ruler of Andor could forget herself with the predecessors who had forged this nation staring down at her. One thing she feared to see, the huge monstrosity of a throne, all gilded dragons that she had seen standing on the dais at the far end of the hall in Tel Iran Riod. It was not there, thank the light. The lion throne no longer rested on a tall plinth like some trophy either, but kept its proper place upon the dais, a massive chair carved and gilded, but sized for a woman. The white lion, picked out in moonstones on a field of rubies, would stand above the head of any woman who sat there. No man could feel at his ease sitting on that throne, because, so legend said, he would know he had sealed his doom. Elaine thought it more likely the builders had simply made sure a man would not fit on it easily. Climbing the white marble steps of the dais, she laid a hand on one arm of the throne. She had no right to sit on it herself. Not yet. Not until she was acknowledged queen. But taking oaths on the lion throne was a custom as old as Andor. She had to resist the desire to simply fall on her knees and weep into the throne's seat. Reconciled to her mother's death she might be, but this brought back all the pain. She could not break down now. "Under the light, I will honor your memory, mother," she said softly. "I will honor the name of Morghaes Trakand and try to bring only honor to House Trakand. I ordered the guards to keep the curious and the favor-seekers away. I suspected you might want to be alone here for a time." Elaine turned slowly to face Dailin Taravin as the golden-haired woman walked the length of the grand hall. Dailin had been one of her mother's earliest supporters in her own quest for the throne. There was more gray in her hair than Elaine remembered, more lines at the corners of her eyes. She was still quite beautiful, a strong woman, and powerful as friend or foe. She stopped at the foot of the dais, looking up. "I've been hearing for 2 days that you were alive, but I didn't really believe it until now. You've come to accept the throne from the Dragon Reborn, then?" "I claim the throne by my own right, Dailin. With my own hand. The lion throne is no bauble to be accepted from a man." Dailin nodded, as at self-evident truth, which it was to any Andoran. "How do you stand, Dailin? With Trakand or against? I have heard your name often on my way here."
"Since you claim the throne by your own right, with."
Few people could sound as dry as she. Elaine sat down on the top step and motioned the older woman to join her. "There are a few obstacles, of course," Dailin went on as she gathered her blue skirts to sit. "There have been several claimants already, as you may know. Nayan and Elenia I have securely locked up, on a charge of treason that most people seem willing to accept, for the time being. Elenia's husband is still active for her, though quietly, and Aramilla has announced a claim, the silly goose. She's getting support of a kind, but nothing that need worry you. Your real worries, aside from Aiel all over the city waiting for the Dragon Reborn to come back, are Aemlyn, Arathel, and Pelavar. For the moment, Luan and Alorian will be behind you, but they might go over to those three." A very succinct list, delivered in a tone suitable for discussing a possible horse race. Nayan and Elenia she knew about, if not that Jared still thought his wife had a chance at the throne. Aramilla was a goose to believe she would be accepted, whatever her support. The last 5 names were worrying, though. Each had been as strong a supporter of her mother as had Dailin, and each led a strong house. "So Arathel and Aemlyn want the throne," Elaine murmured. I can't believe it of Elorian. Not for herself.
Pellavar might be acting for one of his daughters, but Luan had only granddaughters, none near old enough.
You spoke as if they might unite, all five houses. Behind whom?
That would be a dire threat.
Smiling, Dailin propped her chin in her hand.
They seem to think I should have the throne.
Now what do you intend about the dragon reborn? He hasn't been back here in some time, but he can pop out of the air, it seems.
Elaine squeezed her eyes shut for a moment, but when she opened them she was still sitting on the steps of the dais in the grand hall, and Dailin was still smiling at her. Her brother fought for Elida, and her half-brother was a white cloak. She had filled the palace with women who might turn on one another at any moment, not to mention the fact that one was a dark friend, maybe even Black Aja. And the strongest threat she faced in claiming the throne, a very strong one, stood behind a woman who said she supported Elaine. The world was quite mad. She might as well add her bit.
I mean to bond him my warder, she said, and went on before the other woman could more than blink in astonishment. I also hope to marry him. Those things have nothing to do with the Lion Throne, however. The very first thing I intend—
As she went on, Dailin began to laugh. Elaine wished she knew whether it was from delight over her plans, or because Dailin saw her own path to the Lion Throne being made smooth. At least she knew what she faced now.
Riding into Camelon, David Hanlon could not help thinking what a city for the looting it was. In his years soldiering, he had seen many villages and towns looted, and once, 20 years ago, a great city, Kyrian, after the Aiel left. Strange that all these Aiel had left Camelon so apparently untouched, but then, if the tallest towers in Kyrian had not been burning, it might have been hard to know they had been there. Plenty of gold, among other things, lying about for the picking up, and plenty of men to do the picking. He could see these broad streets full of horsemen and fleeing people, fat merchants who would give up their gold before the knife touched them and hoped their lives would be spared, slim girls and plump women so terrified when they were dragged into a corner that they could hardly manage to squeal, much less struggle. He had seen those things and done them, and he hoped to again. Not in Camelon, though, he admitted with a sigh. If the orders that sent him here had been the sort he could disobey, he would have gone where the pickings might not be so rich, but definitely easier to pluck. His instructions had been clear. Stabling his horse at the Red Bull in the new city, he walked a mile to a tall stone house on a side street, the house of a wealthy merchant, discreet about her gold, marked with a tiny painted sigil on the doors, a red heart on a golden hand. The hulking fellow who let him in was no merchant's servant, with his sunken knuckles and sullen eyes. Without a word, the huge man led him deeper into the house, then down toward the basements. Hanlon eased his sword in its scabbard. Among the things he had seen were men and women, failures, led to their own very elaborate executions. He did not think he had failed, but then again, he had hardly succeeded. He had followed orders, though, which was not always enough. In the rough stone basement lit by gilded lamps set all around, his eyes went first to a pretty woman in a lace-trimmed dress of scarlet silk, with her hair caught in frothy lace net. He did not know who this Lady Sheane was, but his orders had been to obey her. He made his best leg, smiling. She simply looked at him, as if waiting for him to notice what else the basement held. He could hardly have missed it, since except for a few casks, the room held only a large, heavy table, decorated in a very strange fashion. Two ovals had been cut in the tabletop, and from one stuck the head and shoulders of a man, his head wrenched back against the wooden surface and held there by means of leather straps nailed to the tabletop and fastened to a block of wood jammed between his teeth. A woman, prepared the same, provided the other decoration. Beneath the table, they knelt with wrists tied to ankles, quite securely held for any sort of pleasure. The man had a touch of gray in his hair and the face of a lord, but unsurprisingly his deep-set eyes rolled wildly. The woman's hair, spread out on the table, was dark and glossy, but her face was a little long for Hanlon's taste. Suddenly he really saw her face, and his hand leaped to his sword before he could stop it. Releasing the hilt took some effort, which he made pains to hide. An Aes Sedai's face, but an Aes Sedai who let herself be fastened like that was no threat. "So you have some brains," Shien said. By her accents, she was a noble, and she certainly had the commanding air, sweeping around the table to peer down into the bound man's face. "I asked the great master Moradin to send me a man with brains. Poor Jacob here has very few." Hanlon frowned and smoothed it away immediately. His orders had come from Mogedion herself. Who in the pit of doom was Moradin? It did not matter. His orders had come from Mogedion, that was enough. The hulking fellow handed Shien a funnel, which she fitted into a hole bored through the block of wood between Jacob's teeth. The man's eyes seemed ready to leap from his head. "Poor Jacob here failed very badly," Shien said, smiling like a fox looking at a chicken. "Moradin wishes him punished. Poor Jacob does like his brandy." She stepped back, not so far that she could not see clearly, and Hanlon gave a start as the hulking man came to the table with one of the casks. Hanlon did think he could have lifted the thing unaided, but the big man tipped it easily. The bound man shrieked once, and then a streak of dark liquid was pouring from the cask into the funnel, turning his cry to gurgling. The rough smell of crude brandy filled the air. Secured as he was, the man fought, thrashing about, even managing to heave the table sideways, but the brandy kept pouring. Bubbles rose in the funnel as he tried to shout or scream, but the steady stream never faltered. And then his thrashing slowed and stopped. Wide, glazing eyes stared up the ceiling, and brandy trickled from his nostrils. The big fellow still did not stop until the last drops fell from an empty cask.
"I think poor Jacob has finally had enough brandy," Shien said, and laughed in delight.
Hanlon nodded. He supposed the man had, at that. He wondered who he had been. Shien was not quite finished. At a gesture from her, the hulking man ripped one of the straps holding the Aes Sedai's gag off of its nail. Hanlon thought the wooden block might have loosened a few of her teeth coming out of her mouth, but if so, she did not waste time on them. She began babbling before the fellow let go of the strap.
"I will obey you," she howled. "I will obey as the great master commanded. He set the shield in me to dissolve so I could obey. He told me so. Let me prove myself. I will crawl. I am a worm, and you are the sun. Oh, please, please, please."
Shien stifled words, if not whimpers, by putting a hand over the Aes Sedai's mouth.
"How do I know you won't fail again, Falian? You have failed before, and Moradin left your punishment to me. He gave me another. Do I need two of you? I may give you a second chance to plead your case, Falian. Perhaps. But if I do, you will have to convince me. I will expect true enthusiasm."
Falian began screaming please again, making extravagant promises the moment Shien's hand moved, but soon enough she was reduced to wordless shrieks and tears as the gag was replaced, the nail driven through the strap again, and Jacob's funnel placed above her gaping throat. The hulking man stood another cask on the table beside her head. The Aes Sedai seemed to go mad, bulging eyes rolling, flinging herself about below the table till it trembled. Hanlon was impressed. An Aes Sedai must be harder to break than a plump merchant or his round-cheeked daughter. Still, she had had the help of one of the Chosen, it seemed. Realizing that Shien was looking at him, he stopped smiling down at Falian. His first rule in life was never to offend those the Chosen set above him.
"Tell me, Hanlon," Shien said, "how would you like to put your hands on a queen?"
He licked his lips in spite of himself. A queen? That he had never done.